Dean, the black-footed ferret, and pick that up. Quite a distinguished-looking group we have.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Silka Kempema, Wildlife Biologist, Game Fish and Parks. I'd like to take the opportunity to introduce my two co-presenters. To my right, Scott Larson. He's a field supervisor with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service office here in South Dakota. And to my left is Dustin Long. He's a wildlife biologist with Turner Endangered Species Fund. Thanks for allowing us to give an update on ferrets in South Dakota today. Kind of the purpose is twofold. One, to put ferret conservation and recovery into context and providing you a little bit of history. That's the role Scott and I are going to play today, and then give you an update on one of the most recent reintroductions in South Dakota. And with that, I'll turn it over to Scott.
Thank you, Silka. Commissioners, I appreciate this chance to talk. I've been with the Fish and Wildlife Service since 87 here in South Dakota, and so I've got a really good background on ferret reintroductions in the state, and over the years I've also had a chance to participate in some of the reintroductions across the nation. So what I hope to do is give you some of that background nationwide and then focus it down to what we've done here in South Dakota, and then I'll hand it off to Silka and then Dustin. But some of the important things to recognize about black-footed ferrets, they're an obligate predator of prairie dogs. So that in and of itself, we've all worked with prairie dogs enough to know that there's issues right off the bat with that when we think about reintroductions. The photo there on the front, we don't think that's necessarily how ferrets actually attain their prey. That happens to be in a captive facility down where we raise them, but it's an important thing to remember that ferrets are not very large, they're a nocturnal animal, they're a short-lived species. So when I say short-lived, three-year-old ferret's a pretty old one. In the wild, they don't live much longer than that. They're quick to reproduce, too. They start reproducing right away at 9 months. The females can get impregnated in that very year. So when they're put into good habitat, they can fill that up very quickly, if you will. They have 3 to 5 kits. They're susceptible to lots of other predators, coyotes, great horned owls. Being a nocturnal predator, most everything at night might clip them if they're out there on that dog town. And then we also believe that prairie dog town provides that important escape habitat through the burrows, as well as some, in addition to the food source, which is primarily prairie dogs, also that escape from those climatic extremes that we see across the range. Too hot in the summer, too cold in the winter, but underground it's much moderated. So when we think about ferrets, we know that they existed in 3 of the 5 species of prairie dogs in North America. The blacktail one, which we have here in South Dakota, was far and away the largest part of that range, and they also existed in Gunnison and whitetails. So when we think about recovering the critter, it makes sense to try to put them in all 3 of those species as well. And also, because we know of the threats that exist for them, not put those all in one spot. So part of our strategy over the decades has been try to spread them out throughout that range, as well as amongst those 3 species of prairie dogs. And those so ferrets were known to be in 12 states historically. So when we think about what caused that decline, we know a lot of that rangeland that they used to exist in, those prairie dogs, had been converted to cropland. We know there were large-scale poisoning programs from the turn of the century on, and a lot of the toxicants, rodenticides, that were used could also kill ferrets or other critters that might eat those poisoned prairie dogs. We've since shifted to some other rodenticides that don't necessarily act that way. And then sylvatic plague, that's a old-world disease that we believe got into the new world here in about 1907. And that came in, we believe, through a port in San Francisco, and it's been working its way east since. And it seems so we have a lot of the rodent populations, if you will, whether they be colonial ground squirrels or prairie dogs, seem highly susceptible to those. And ferrets turned out to be one of the critters that is also really susceptible to that. And Sylvatic plague, those plague outbreaks, have turned out to be amongst the biggest challenges we've had with ferret recovery. And then in certain circumstances, recreational shooting can be a challenge, but that's much easier managed than Sylvatic plague and those sort of things. Millett County, so some of the last areas that ferrets were known was down in Millett County. And so there was a observation by a young child down there who's still alive to this day. I've had the chance to talk to him a couple of times. And that started some of the first research on black-footed ferrets that we knew of. Back when SDSU was still known as a college, that research started. And we learned some of the first insights about ferret biology, what they need to live on, their nocturnal nature, just the basic biology. So really good stuff came out of that. By the time that study was kind of wrapping up, we weren't finding many ferrets, so we tried to capture up a few, and they were brought back to the Smithsonian Zoo in Washington and tried to reproduce, tried to captive breed them. We were unsuccessful. So when those captive ferrets died out and we couldn't find any more in the wild, we presumed they could be extinct. We thought the opportunity had been missed to save this species. It turned out in 81 another population was found out in an area near Meteetse, Wyoming. These were in whitetail prairie dog colonies, but it was another case where there was a good, robust population of ferrets, so there was a chance to do more research, and that's exactly what happened. What happened, though, as from 81 till 85, towards the later end of that period, Sylvatic plague got into that population, and we started seeing those prairie dog numbers drop off as well as the ferret numbers. And a decision was made to try to capture up some ferrets for captive breeding again. And so 18 were captured up, but a lot of them were moms with kids. So we didn't necessarily have a lot of distinct individuals. We had a lot. Turned out we had 7 founder animals. So all the ferrets we know of today, and we'll get to this a little bit later, all the ferrets we know come from those 7 founding strains or lines of genetics, if you will. So it's a constrained animal that we're working with, for sure, genetically. Our captive breeding program, we did have success. Our first one started out in Sabillo, Wyoming there, working with the Wyoming Game and Fish, and we were able to reproduce them, and reproduce them in a way that we had enough we could start thinking about reintroductions. And turns out what we learned over the years is that it's really important to have those captive ferrets spend some time in the dirt learning to kill prairie dogs again. We couldn't just kick them out the door, if you will, at a certain age unless they had had some training. So our captive facilities have these pens where they're exposed to live prairie dogs and they learn to kill again, if you will, those prairie dogs. And that has been successful. So when we think about recovery across the range, you can see this. These are the projections for each state. We recognize some states may or may not participate, and some states have participated well, and South Dakota is one of those states. But over the years, with the 7 reintroductions in South Dakota, those are the numbers our recovery would try to attain. And on some years, we've had many more ferrets than that in South Dakota. We've had Sylvatic plague come into the state in 2008, and it's really dropped off our ferret numbers. But what we tried to do with this recovery planning is make sure we could engage as many of our partners as we could, as well as have attainable goals. And so those are what we would want to achieve in order to downlist the species from endangered to threatened, or delist the species completely off the list. I'll come back to plague a little bit because that seems to be our biggest nemesis, if you will. Sylvatic plague is that non-native bacteria that was introduced in the New World. And the way it works, we think the key vector is fleas. And so when that flea that is infected, if it bites a ferret, the ferret might get it that way, or the prairie dog could get it if it gets bit. Prairie dogs are really a social animal, so once you have one of those infected, we think they can spread it amongst themselves as well. And that's why how we've seen over the years, some of these colonies can look fine 1 week, and the next week you might go out there and there's 500 or 1,000 acres are gone. It can happen very quick once it start spreading. And then we also know that a ferret can also eat an infected prairie dog and get it that way. And what we know is ferrets are very susceptible to plague, so they don't develop titers. Generally, they die from it. Other critters, coyotes, can eat an infected prairie dog, and we think most of those survive, and they'll show that through a titer in their blood, so you can tell if a canine's been exposed to it or not. And those happen to be one of the animals we can test and find out if plague might be in the system. So when we think about plague management options, part of it is a risk management. Don't have all your ferret recovery in one or two sites. Spread them out across that big range that exists. Have lots of sites, maybe smaller sites and bigger sites. We also know that we can do flea control, and that's what we have called dusting, where you spray a flea powder down the burrow, and that's had really good success for a time period. But we also know fleas can develop resistance to that insecticide as well. So we need a variety of tools, as you might think. We're exploring others. A grain bait called fipronil seems to be showing some progress. We also have developed some vaccines where you can individually vaccinate a ferret, and that has shown good work too, but it's very difficult to administer vaccines 30 days apart, a booster shot to a wild critter. And then we are also developing a prairie dog vaccine. Could you have it in a bait and a prairie dog eat it and vaccinate the prairie dog? And that has showed promise too, at least in the laboratory. We know that it isn't passed on to their young, so we don't expect them, you know, you'd have to, again, go out and do that on a semi-regular basis. And it probably only makes sense to do that where you're putting the investment of a ferret reintroduction. You wouldn't do that broad scale across the range or anything, just on those ferret reintroduction sites. This slide, unfortunately, doesn't show up too well, but this is the 30 sites that currently ferrets have been reintroduced in. The first one started back in 91, and the last one was last year down on the Moore Ranch in New Mexico. But you can make out some of those numbers. Seven of the sites are up here in South Dakota, so seven out of the 30. The ferrets themselves are not very hard to capture up. Once you see them in the wild, you're monitoring them at night, and you chase them down a burrow. They're pretty easy to capture up, and over the years, we've had lots of volunteers. This was a Girl Scout troop down in Arizona that helped at the Aubrey Valley site, and they became very adept at catching ferrets. And this is what reintroduction looks like now. They come out of the captive center, they've been trained to kill prairie dogs again, and they're released from a dog kennel. And that part of it goes pretty smooth. It's that all-night monitoring that can be challenging. And of course, there's a broad list of partners across the range too. Really good folks throughout, even Mexico and Canada participate in this as well. And then in South Dakota, each one of these sites, that's when ferrets actually hit the ground. The Kanata Basin Badlands area, ferrets were first put there in Badlands National Park in 94. We went onto the grasslands right next to the park in 96. And that site has turned out to be kind of the gold standard across the whole recovery range. It's the largest site. It's where most of a lot of the resources and research has been done to try to figure out how to combat plague. I think at each one of those other sites, so three of them are tribal sites, and on each of those sites, the tribal sites in particular, it's the tribe that's running the reintroduction there. Rosebud was active for a few years and then they pulled back and haven't been active for a while. But one of the key things that we found when we have had success with ferrets at a site, roadkills tend to start showing up. And so down at Rosebud, after two or three years of reintroductions, we had three roadkills picked up. You know, that seems to be a okay metric to know that your population is doing okay. We've had plague come into some of that area now and we haven't had a roadkill down there for maybe 8 years, so I don't have confidence there's much of a population left, if at all, down there. But that's a decent pattern, is if you're finding roadkills, you've probably got a population still chugging along. So I think that's where I'll hand it off to Silke.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Silke Kempema. So before I get into a little bit about Game Fish and Parks' role in ferret recovery, I just want to recognize and thank Scott and Dustin and all the other conservation partners that have been involved in ferret recovery. It's over the years that I've worked with ferrets, it's fairly obvious that these sites are partnerships, and it's a lot of work by a lot of different people and a lot of different organizations. And professionally, for me, that's very rewarding, and it helps achieve conservation goals. And that's supposed to be Dustin, Scott, and I right there. We aren't really that cute, though. So first, it's our responsibility, and we have authority to do this from the State Wildlife Agency's perspective. There is a state threatened and endangered species law, and in that law, it says Game Fish and Parks shall perform acts necessary for the conservation, management, protection, restoration, propagation of endangered, threatened, and non-game species of wildlife. As part of that law, it also requires that we do a status review. You guys are familiar with this. We presented a status review last year, which included all species, including the ferret. And as part of the status review for this species, we said we'd cooperate with the Fish and Wildlife Service in meeting the downlisting and delisting goals that were identified in the federal recovery plan. In the event it is downlisted or delisted within the state, we would reevaluate delisting criteria for the species within our boundaries. Also, our responsibility and authority, there's a section of the Endangered Species Act, Section 6. It addresses partnerships with states, in a word. And within that, we have an agreement, a Section 6 agreement that it's called, referred to, Agreement to Cooperate in the Conservation and Recovery of Listed Species. It's notable that we've had this agreement with the Fish and Wildlife Service since 1977. It's renewed annually. Again, we've committed to helping the Fish and Wildlife Service meet downlisting and delisting goals. We also share data and we cooperate. As part of Section 6, there is funding available to the states, and especially before that first reintroduction of ferrets occurred in South Dakota, those funds were used to conduct disease research to assess risk, both pre and post of that reintroduction. And that was 6 years of research that was conducted in the early 1990s. And that's just one example of use of those dollars. And then also, those dollars were used to monitor South Dakota's first reintroduced population via radio telemetry, and that was fairly important too. It's a little bit hard to slap on a collar on an animal that doesn't have a lot of shoulders or neck. So there was some research and information collected from those efforts. So I'll talk a little bit more about the conservation actions, specifically relationships, partnerships, and then reintroductions. Relationships. With all of the reintroductions that have occurred in South Dakota, beginning with Kanata Basin up to Turner's reintroduction of ferrets, there's been extensive public involvement. As Scott alluded to, one of the challenges is finding a place where we have enough prairie dogs at a level that's tolerable. One of the things that we'll often hear is, I have nothing against ferrets, it's the prairie dogs that I don't like. So conservation and recovery of ferrets is also related to conservation of prairie dogs as well, at least at a local level. Ferrets need prairie dogs, and finding the places that had enough prairie dogs. And up to the recent past, most of those areas have been on either federal lands or tribal lands. Addressing neighboring landowners. I know there's going to be folks that aren't going to want or really prefer either ferrets or prairie dogs coming onto their property. And Scott might be able to speak to this a little bit better too, but if there is a reintroduction site and ferrets enter into the neighboring landowner's property, if the Fish and Wildlife Service is told, they'll come and get those ferrets. Maybe the bigger issue is unwanted prairie dog encroachment. That issue is addressed in our state prairie dog management plan. The specific role that Game Fish and Parks has had is to address unwanted encroachment of prairie dogs from public land to private land, and similarly, Department of Agriculture will address those issues on a private-to-private encroachment. And some of the partnerships, you know, these partnerships are, you know, we've got a common goal. On the Blackfooted Fairy Recovery Implementation Team, this is a group of individuals that essentially represent the reintroductions across the range. So there's a team at the national level, also a team at the state level, and Game Fish and Parks has had representatives on these teams since their inception. And the Kanata coordination meeting, and we just had this earlier this week, and sitting at the table looking at the different representatives, it was fairly impressive. This meeting has gone on probably annually since for over two decades. And some of the representatives there, Fish and Wildlife Service, Forest Service, Game and Fish, Park Service, some NGOs, Prairie Wildlife Research, some additional NGOs from year to year, and then also U.S. Geological Survey. They kind of represent the research end of things. But it's fairly impressive that that type of partnership has lasted for that many years. And then the Prairie Dog Conservation Team. This team wasn't necessarily formed as a result of conserving ferrets. It was actually formed as a result of the threat of endangered species listing of the black-tailed prairie dog. But this is something that was led by the Western Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies. The states within the range of the prairie dog got together. How can we essentially prevent the federal listing of this species and still try and keep it on the landscape? Prairie dogs and ferrets are closely associated, but Game Fish and Parks has been an active participant on this team since its inception as well. So touch a little bit more on the reintroductions that Scott mentioned. Those first two, Badlands and Buffalo Gap National Grasslands, those are the ones that has been referred to as Kanata Basin, and that has been the reintroduction site for ferrets across its range. And that column on the left, that's the current number of ferrets that we think are in that area, and that changes every year after surveys. But so approximately we have about 160 ferrets in South Dakota right now. And with that, I've got Bad River Ranch highlighted, and this reintroduction is unique in South Dakota. Not only is it the most recent one, but it's the first one that's occurred on private lands. All the other reintroductions have been federal or tribal properties. Another unique thing is this reintroduction site has been, I guess, authorized from a programmatic safe harbor agreement for black-footed ferrets. This is a part of the Endangered Species Act that encourages private landowners who want to conserve threatened or endangered species to be able to do so on their property. It gives them regulatory assurances and flexibility, and it says if one day they're like, I'm done with it, they're done with it, and that's fine. And it also addresses neighboring landowners as well. So with that, I'll turn it over to Dustin to give you a little bit more details about Bad River.
Commissioners, I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today about our 19-year effort to return black-footed ferrets and black-tailed prairie dogs to the landscape at Bad River Ranches. Before I get into the prairie dogs and the ferret aspect of it, I'd like to provide a little bit of background, a recent background on Bad River Ranches. As you can see, Bad River Ranches isn't very far from Pierre, and as you might guess by looking at the boundaries, it wasn't a single land purchase. It was actually 16 land purchases made over several years. The first four major land acquisitions were made in 1999. It's a 141,000-acre property. It's the largest private landowning in Stanley and Jones County and also within the state. It's also the largest bison operation in North America. For some perspective, you've heard about the Yellowstone National Park bison herd. That's 5,000 animals. Bad River runs between 7,000 and 8,000 animals. So it's half again as many bison that are in Yellowstone. From the very beginning, conservation, restoration, and research have been a focus at the property. Soon after purchase, 8,400 acres of farmland were returned to grassland. We still do maintain about 260 acres of wildlife food plots. All 38 river miles of the Bad River that flow through the property have been fenced off to aid in riparian restoration, delimit erosion, and sedimentation into Lake Sharp. Some of our single species projects have included swift fox reintroductions, native pollinator and monarch work, and then, of course, certainly the most controversial project we've taken up at Bad River has been the black-footed ferret and black-tailed prairie dog project. Now, unlike most other release sites in North America, Bad River ranches initially did not have enough prairie dogs to support a ferret population, so we had to be proactive. It was a blank canvas. We had to be proactive in establishing prairie dogs. You can see in 1999, that's what the prairie dog colonies on the ranch looked like. Those are the red polygons. So we went through the ranch and looked at soil, slope, vegetation, other considerations, and selected the Ash Creek pasture as the site for prairie dog restoration and ultimately ferret reintroductions. To get that prairie dog population up to a point where we could support ferrets, we performed translocations. We'd go out and trap prairie dogs, move them up there, soft release them, create some artificial burrows for them, and then let them go. Ranch-wide, using this method, we increased acreage from 670 acres to over 3,000 acres over a 12-year period. Within Ash Creek itself, the acreage increased from 125 acres up to 1,600 acres. And throughout this period, we didn't have any, we had no indication that plague was going to be a problem for us. As you might imagine, as these colonies expanded and became and moved closer to neighboring properties, there were some concerns. We investigated and used non-lethal and lethal control of prairie dogs. Some of the non-lethal methods we used were visual barriers, straw bales, vinyl barriers. If a prairie dog can't see past a certain point, they tend not to push beyond that. They want to have an open field of vision. The most effective method for controlling prairie dog encroachment onto neighbors was actually just to keep the bison out of an area. So we fenced off from our property boundary 100 meters back. The bison couldn't access that. If the bison can't graze, the prairie dogs don't move into it. They need for that area to be grazed in order for them to move into it. To enhance that, we also erected raptor perches, which further discouraged prairie dogs colonizing those areas. In those areas where prairie dogs, where we don't have fences up, we do allow some prairie dog shooting. I think a little bit of money's made on that. And if things get bad, we will use toxicants, but that's sort of a last resort for us on the property. At any rate, by 2009, we'd increased that population up in Ash Creek to about 1,500 acres. And so instead of going to a full-scale release that would count towards species recovery, we started what we called a wild preconditioning releases. What that entailed was releasing 10 to 15 ferrets every year in the fall, let them run wild for 2 or 3 months, and then recapture them. We'd go out every night, monitor them, keep track of them, see where they, what habitat they were using. This would not contribute to federal recovery objectives, and it allowed us to do two things. It allowed us to determine whether we had enough prairie dogs in Ash Creek to support a ferret population. It also allowed us to introduce the idea of ferrets on the landscape to our neighbors in sort of a gentle way, because they would be recaptured and sent off after 2 or 3 months. During that 3-year period, we released 37 ferrets and we were able to recapture 17 of them. We determined during that period that we did have enough acreage up there to support ferrets, and in 2012 began the process of acquiring the necessary permits, the public outreach, that sort of stuff for a 2013 release. Well, unfortunately, in 2012, plague moved into the prairie dog complex and essentially decimated it. We didn't have enough prairie dogs out there to support a ferret reintroduction, so we had to stop that effort. So, to get that prairie dog population back up again from 2012 to 2017, as Scott mentioned, we dusted with deltamethrin. That kills fleas. Fleas are the vector for the disease. If you kill break that cycle, plague tends not to pop up. And so from 2012 to 2017, this slide isn't complete, We dusted, and by 2017, we had increased the acreage up to 1,800 acres up in Ash Creek. That was enough acreage to support a ferret population. And so we released ferrets in the fall of 2017. In 2017, we also applied what's called the Sylvatic Plague Vaccine to the prairie dog colonies. So we didn't dust the colonies. We applied a vaccine. I have some here. One of you guys want to take it up to them? What it is, it's a bait. It's an oral bait. This is spread on a colony at 50 pellets per acre. The prairie dogs eat that, and they're vaccinated against the plague. It's an oral vaccine. It's a lot easier to apply than going to each individual burrow and dusting. And so we were counting on that to keep our prairie dogs alive while we released ferrets. Unfortunately, by the early summer 2018, it became clear the plague had again moved into the complex. The oral plague vaccine, or the Sylvatic plague vaccine that we had used, just didn't work. The plague moved through the colony very quickly. We were able to save some portions of the colony through dusting, but everything that we had applied the SPV to was gone. So we had ferrets on the landscape for several months. They're no longer there because the prairie dogs are no longer there. And so that's where we stand today. I know it's not a happy story. We will persist. We will continue to try to get ferrets on that landscape. We've got to find a way to develop an efficacious and an affordable plague management tools before we can do that. We're going to persist. And I'd like to acknowledge the help of the Department, Fish and Wildlife Service, some of our neighbors and the biologists that have worked on these projects over the years. Again, it's a 19-year effort. I've had 10 minutes to give you 19 years of what's happened. This is really, you know, I've left a lot of details out. But we appreciate your support in all this. Thank you.
Thank you. Just a question about the plague. It seems to me on my ranch that, you know, it comes and goes. But a lot of times there'll be three or four prairie dogs that survive that. Do they build up any kind of immunity, or are they just lucky?
I think it's both, Commissioner Jensen. What we've had a chance in Montana, we've looked at those really close, and about 30% of those survivors do seem to develop titers. So they were exposed and survived. The other 70 that didn't have any titers, it was probably luck. They just didn't catch it.
Yeah.
But what we haven't yet seen where that gets passed on, or that those exposed but survivors have greater immunity than the next time it comes. They're a pretty short-lived critter, so it doesn't seem to be protecting them in Montana to much of a degree anyway.
So that plague comes, like, seems like it'll rotate about every 8-10 years through towns.
I think that's fair. Some sites we seem to see it come through even faster. So Dustin's, I think you had maybe a 4-year gap, but we've had just like that, and we've had some odd circumstances where it hasn't returned for quite some time, more than that. So there's lots of things about plague we don't have figured out yet.
Sure. Yeah, go ahead, Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You spoke about the limited genetic variability that we have because of 7 strains that were captured. Is there still, this species was considered extinct at one time, and we discovered one group that was still alive. Is there hope that there's strains out there that we don't know anything about, that there's populations that haven't been discovered in the vast area that the black-tailed prairie dog actually exists in? Are we looking for more?
We have over the years. In fact, after Metizi was found, the thought was, well, we missed them once. Could we have done again? And there was significant effort by a lot of game and fish agencies to go out and look again. We didn't find any that way. And the other clue that leads me to think we're not necessarily missing them is that when they were on the landscape, we tended to have road kills. unless you're in that really remote country like Meeteetse. But in South Dakota, we were having road kills through the 60s and a little bit of the 70s. Colorado the same way. So I tend to think we're not going to find that. But when we think about strains, some of the folks have said, we've got all these ferret mounts. We've got ferret pelts from 1900. Could you extract some of that old genetic information, salvage it, if you will, and recombinate it, or that terminology where we're taking, you know, mammoths from 10,000 years ago, and we might be able to have a critter. So there's some of that strange thing going on. I don't know if that'll ever materialize. We've always focused on the genetics are what they are, and we've tried to, rather than let one or two males, and they're a male-dominated species where one would try to breed every female in captivity. We keep even those males that aren't necessarily very aggressive. We keep those breeding to try to keep that strain going as much as we can. But out in the wild, it's likely we have just a few males doing a lot of the siring.
Sharp. Mr. Sharp here. Good presentation. Two questions. How does the plague show up in an area when you haven't had any plague? It's almost been a controlled population. And two is aerial application has not been perfected to the point that that's workable, is what I would guess.
That is fair, Commissioner Sharp. We haven't perfected aerial. We are starting to look at some things like with ATVs where you might be able to disperse that bait, maybe drones, and maybe we could eventually get to aerial application if we have the right product that works. As Dustin mentioned, that product didn't work, and that one would be possible to be applied aerially, but we've got to get a product that works.
But as dusting has got to be right down into the hole, and it can't be just dispersed?
Correct. Okay. Yeah. As for how plague might get into an area, we're not sure, but oftentimes prairie dogs are one of our first sentinels that we know that it's there, much like a canary in a gold mine. One day the prairie dog town looks fine. A week later, it's hardly occupied at all. And we know if you know you didn't poison it, then that's the first culprit you might suspect. And so that's how it was discovered in 2004 in Custer County, the first time we know that it came into South Dakota. It was because of a dog town that a rancher had been around for decades, and all of a sudden it was blinked out, and he reported it, and that's how we were tipped off. And in 2005, it got into that great big colony in Shannon County, big colony being about a 30,000-acre colony, and it chewed through that over that summertime, and you could watch it progress and take out 1,000, 5,000-acre chunks of that town over that summer. But we don't know how it actually got here.
So, I mean, a predator's bringing it in, a bird of prey, you know, carrying something in. It seems odd that you can have something isolated and all of a sudden that flea gets...
Well, as you can imagine, there's lots of critters that move. Some coyotes, 30 miles is not an unheard of distance, of course, in a fairly short time. And I just hate to speculate on how it's getting here.
Just a curiosity question. Good presentation again. Thank you.
Oh. Okay. Thank you, guys. Silke, you're going to do otter too,
are
you?
Oh, sure.
Okay.